from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum in this morning's second hour, nearly 15 years ago, best-selling author Francine Prose spied an intriguing photograph at a museum exhibit. One of the subjects of the photo was a cross-dressing woman named Violet Morris, a lesbian professional auto racer who worked for the Gestapo during World War II. The photo and Morris's life story served as the inspiration for Prose's new novel, Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932, which is told through the eyes of a diverse group of characters against the backdrop of a Parisian nightclub. Francine Prose joins us for Forum's next hour after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of our Forum program. Award-winning author Francine Prose is the author of such novels as A Changed Man and Blue Angel and a number of other works, including Anne Frank, The Book, The Life, The Afterlife, and Reading Like a Writer. Her most recent novel is Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris 1932, which pulls us into a compelling and multiple point of view story featuring a gifted French lesbian athlete named Lou Villars, who worked for the Gestapo, an American writer reminiscent of Henry Miller, maybe Ernest Hemingway, also a Hungarian photographer, a virgin baroness married to a homosexual automaker, and perhaps the novel's most central character, Paris of the 1920s and 1930s. And Francine Prose joins us in studio for this morning's second hour. So good to have you back on Forum.
Thanks, Michael.
Well, Michael Cunningham calls you the Hope Diamond of literature. Are you over that yet?
I don't know. When I first saw the blurb, of course, I was very happy and grateful. And then I thought, Hope Diamond kind of sounds like a stripper's name. So.
Well, it's high praise. And I give this novel high praise. I mean, it just kept me turning pages, and that's good in itself. But it's also really, in some ways, a remarkable achievement. And as I started reading it, I thought, boy, there's not only a lot of cross-dressing, there's a lot about Joan of Arc, and there's a lot about insomnia. We'll get into some of those.
You know, insomnia was the book's original title. I mean, it wouldn't have been nearly so good a title, but I thought, oh, what do these characters have in common? They're all, or a number of them are insomniacs, as am I. And it was the working title for quite a long time until I found a better one.
Well, some of those things can't help seeping into your work. There are some great turns and twists to this story, though, and it's from so many multiple points of view that I want to talk to you about that. It kept me up. But I said Paris is really a central character, and it reminded me of reading Simeon in a way. You know, you're there in the city at its time.
Well, it's Paris and what happened to Paris? Paris in the 20s and 30s when everything was bright and golden and full of writers and artists and hope. And then all the political turmoil in the 30s, the Popular Front and the rioting between the right and the left, and then the invasion in 1940, the German invasion. So I wanted to cover that whole scope.
But you do it with the multiple points of view. You do it through letters, through memoirs. You do it through actually a number of writers, through a biography of Lou Villars and so forth. And yet you keep the plot moving along. I mean, this is it's always seemed to me to be a really formidable task. I mean, Faulkner does it. You know, some great writers do it. You're worthy of that esteem. But it's a difficult task.
It was so hard. It was so hard. I mean, it was hard because the multiple narrators, and also because each one of them has a different idea of what happened. I mean, they're not just narratives, but they're conflicting narratives. So I finally had to go out and get a whiteboard and do a little grid of the years, how old everybody was, where they were, what happened historically, and what they thought about what happened historically.
It's like a cubist painting in some ways. I mean, you know, you look at it from different angles and you find different truths. And what you realize, of course, is sort of the multivalent nature of truth or just even of history and narratives. Even the journalism comes into play here.
Yeah, of subjectivity. I mean, there's one line in the book where Lou says something like, the French would learn from the Germans how to be kind and compassionate. And I thought, well, that line is the definition of subjectivity.
Yeah. Well, Lou is very, she's seduced by the Führer. In fact, you know, writing, talk about formidable tasks, writing a scene where Hitler is your dinner partner by itself. A lot of temerity at that.
That was so much fun. That was a shocking amount of fun. But, you know, I had a lot of help because there's this book called Hitler's Table Talk that Bormann wrote down everything Hitler said at dinner for 4 years, I think, shatteringly boring. I mean, you can barely read it, but I was just able to kind of adapt big sections of it and put them into Hitler's mouth in the novel.
But he seems, well, again, this is sort of from Lou's point of view, or from at least the point of view that is represented at that point, you know, kind of a charming dinner mate of sorts. I mean, he doesn't want anybody drinking, and his vegetarianism right, comes in. But, you know, she was certainly intoxicated with him, and so was her friend Inga, to put it mildly.
Well, a lot of people seem to have thought he was charming and charismatic. I mean, it's hard to, you know, as several characters say in the book, you see him in the newsreels, and he just looks like this maniac puppet jumping up and down. But the German people were swayed by him.
German people were madly in love with him, truth be told. Let's get back to the whole question of history, though, and what you're working with here. I mean, I mentioned Faulkner. It reminded me a lot of Absalom Absalom. You know, not only does it bend who's telling the story, but history itself becomes a subject of fiction and a subject of not only subjectivity, but our imaginations.
Well, one of the things that was strange about writing the novel and that made it harder, only because I didn't have a model to go to, was that except for one character, I mean, there's these six or seven narrative voices, except for one character, they're all writing something. I mean, it's not as if they're talking into the ozone. There's a novel being written, there are letters being written, there are several memoirs being written. And each one, each narrator, each writer thinks of him or herself as writing a work of history. And that was really, that was quite difficult.
And also writing what they saw to a great extent, mm-hmm. or what they perceived. So it is indeed their truth.
Mm-hmm.
And it also has, of course, the haze of memory, because some of it's being, although the letters that Gabor, were you thinking of the Gabor sisters, by the way, when you name a Hungarian
It was the only Hungarian name. No, you know, what you can do now, I went on the internet and looked at Hungarian first names until I found the one that I like.
Well, I thought of Zsa Zsa, of course, and all that. But he's writing. He's a very devoted son. He's writing letters to his parents, and it gives you an epistolary quality to the novel as well. But it's very different than the other memoir, biography, etc. So you've got different genres,
mm-hmm,
really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also the Brassai, the great photographer on whom he's based, loosely based, wrote letters back to his family in Hungary. So I had this whole book of Brassai's letters to look at again and borrow a little bit from, or at least the tone. But, you know, but also I was interested, I mean, as the mother of two grown sons, I was very interested in the relationship between grown children, that oxymoron, and their parents. So yes, I was writing about Brassai. Yes, I was writing about Paris. But I was also writing about that strange relationship that you have with your kids when they're grown up, or they have with you.
So I diligently avoided reading any reviews of this book, but I did see one, and he said, obviously, Gabor is based on Man Ray.
I know. Did it? I haven't seen that one. Well, that's so much for subjectivity.
But there is, I mean, Louis Villars, who is the main character, and who the biographer is writing about, and who becomes a Nazi and a torturer and a spy for the Gestapo against her beloved French nation, is based on a real character.
She's based on a woman named Violette Morris, who was a French athlete, auto racer, professional auto racer, discus thrower, javelin thrower, Olympic hopeful. And then in 1935, the French government took away her license to compete professionally because she was a cross-dresser, a very open, out cross-dresser. And Hitler somehow found out about it and invited her to be his guest at the Berlin Olympics. And by the time she got back to France, she was not only spying for the Germans, but she was the person who told them where the Maginot Line ended so they could invade France. And she did become a torture for the Gestapo and was assassinated by the resistance in 1944. So those were sort of the bones of the novel. Those were the dots that I had to connect. That was all I knew.
But you had a photograph, too, didn't you?
Oh, well, there's that beautiful Brassai photograph of her and some unnamed girlfriend sitting in a bar in Le Monocle, a cross-dressers club in Paris in 1932.
So you invented the Chameleon Club.
Uh-huh. That was so much fun. I mean, inventing my own cross-dressers club in Paris in the 30s, the dance routines, the music, the musicians, the waiters, the clientele. It was a fantastic amount of fun.
And it's palpable. I mean, you bring us there. But you also, the fascinating thing about this is the photograph that you use in the book, mm-hmm. was not actually taken at the Chameleon Club. It was taken at a facsimile of the Chameleon Club that was created by this money of this baroness who is essentially in love with Gabor.
Mm-hmm. Well, Brassai also staged a lot of his photos. I mean, he recreated things from memory or things from life. But in the case of the book, he wasn't allowed to take pictures at the club because nobody goes to a crossdresser's club to get their picture taken. So, or very few people, I would think. So he had to set up a studio someplace else so he could have all the time he needed for an exposure to get the lighting right, et cetera, et cetera.
There's this also nasty character, Shinaka Corsican, who essentially represents the ultimate bureaucrat who manages to use his sadism and his nastiness to stay at the top. Was he based on anybody?
He was based on an amalgam of French politicians and policemen during that time. But he was also based on, I mean, one of the things about him is he keeps failing at his job, and then he keeps winding up in better and better jobs. So we've all kind of known people like that. So, you know, he was based on several real-life people whose name will go unmentioned.
Peter Principle, I think they used to call that.
Oh, is that right?
That's
right.
To the level of your own incompetence or something along those lines. Yeah. So did you know what was going to happen in this plot? You said you had a grid. Did you stake it all out?
I knew what happened in Lou's life. I mean, that I knew. And I knew that she would be assassinated. I mean, that's not a spoiler. That's clear from the beginning. But there was a lot I didn't know. And I especially didn't know how I was going to end it. So I was really kind of flying on instruments or blind or however they say, just hoping that this was going to work out. Okay.
You see, it's a spoiler and you know the ending. Do you believe in fortune telling with various kinds of newts or lizards or things of that sort?
I convinced myself it was possible. And in fact, in the book, it works. So maybe it is.
Exactly why I thought of it, yeah. It's a rich novel, and it's a novel that has you know, some very disturbing things in it, but it also has a lot of romance and has a lot of love and a lot of gaiety and a lot of mixed relationships. And of course, one of the characters I thought was maybe based on Henry Miller, but maybe Hemingway, Lionel, is a fascinating character. He was like a lot of those bohemians who found themselves as expats in Paris.
He was based on Henry Miller, and I went back and read a lot of Henry Miller. Not a great idea, but because I've been a huge Henry Miller fan when I was a kid, and now
I've got feminist credentials. Forget it.
Sorry. And now I was less enchanted. But you know, that wine, women, song, sex, Paris, music, et cetera, and also art, egomania, self-expression, all those things got put into those sections, which I have to say were the easiest, and shockingly, the easiest to write in the novel. My own, I was getting in touch with my inner Henry Miller, I guess.
Well, his voice is certainly a credible one. It sounds like a lot of the Henry Miller type characters, those who aspire to be like Henry Miller. The other thing, talk about your feminist credentials. I mean, there's some really rotten women in here, and I don't even mean necessarily Lou. I mean Arlette, who's like a viper, and Inga. And I'm reminded of a conversation with Margaret Atwood where she said, you know, feminists have to loosen up because there are a lot of bad women and write about bad women.
Well, have we ever heard the words Margaret Thatcher? I mean, gender is no guarantee of a high moral quality, as we've all learned to, you know, nor is it any guarantee that women will treat one another better than men do.
You've also got a lot of cameos and walk-ons in here. I mean, Picasso, the Hindenburg, Schmeling, Piaf. You know, people are going to probably think of the Woody Allen movie, but this was probably in your head long before that.
It was. And also, I read somewhere that, I thought it too, that the Woody Allen movie was kind of like the Wikipedia version of Paris in the 20s. And I was hoping to do something that went a little deeper than that. But there, I mean, the fun cameo to write was Picasso. I mean, there's one line, the Henry Miller character says something like, I don't want a name drop, but Picasso told me a story. I wrote that line, I quit for the day. I was like, I'm done.
You still writing every day? Did you write with this every day?
I wrote as much as I could, and it took 5 years. And 3 of those years, I thought, I just can't do it. It's too hard. And then somehow it all came into place.
Harder than writing about Anne Frank?
Harder in a different way. I mean, there I had the information. That was very painful. But in this case, I just didn't know. It was so complicated and so long and so many characters and so many voices and so many things to keep straight and so much to remember because the fact that they all have different versions of what happened meant that I had to remember what their versions were and then what actually happened. So there was a lot to kind of, you know, a lot of things to keep juggling.
talking with Francine Prose, I thought of juggling as I read the book, actually. I thought of you juggling.
it's the one thing that doesn't happen in the Chameleon Club.
Her book is Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. You also had to learn a great deal about auto manufacturing and car racing and all that.
Yeah. I have all these books about luxury cars and race cars from the 30s now, picture books. So I would spend a lot of time just looking at pictures. And on YouTube, you can find these amazing clips from the time of auto races, of people driving down the highway in France in 1924. And there's a scene near the end of the last public guillotine execution in France, and you can watch it on YouTube. I mean, it's a horrible scene. Don't, you know, kids, don't do this at home. But I could, but there it was, the film's up there.
There's also a lot in this novel about French nationalism and French xenophobia. I mean, it was so extant at the time, so pervasive, really.
I was, you know, it's so interesting that you said that, because I hadn't exactly started out to write about nationalism. It just wasn't, you know, I knew insomnia, I knew cross-dressing, I knew all these, Joan of Arc, in fact, I knew. But nationalism, as I wrote, I thought, this is more and more becoming the topic that I'm writing about. And then it all kind of fit together. I mean, the way in which the veneration of Joan of Arc fit into the whole nationalistic scheme was there it was, and I just had to kind of remember it or discover it.
In fact, the two auto manufacturers, one is Didi, the homosexual who's married to the Baroness, and his brother, who turns out to be one of the original founders of Mel Gibson's Opus Dei. We even bring that into the picture.
I know. Opus Dei. Well, I have a slight obsession with Opus Dei. So again, what are my personal obsessions? I've been obsessed with Joan of Arc since I was in high school. And then when I wrote an article about Mel Gibson's, in fact, The Passion of the Christ, and suddenly became obsessed with Opus Dei. So, you know, as a way, I mean, 448 pages, there's enough room to get my own obsessions in there.
Yeah, you do that very well. Also, Joan of Arc was kind of a cross-dresser, but also one who heard voices. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I remember somebody writing when Son of Sam was thinking he was hearing voices. You know, well, Joan of Arc thought she, and there was a lot of real revulsion at that. You could make even an analogy between Joan of Arc, who still is canonized. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, read mm-hmm. Shaw St. Joan. I mean, still venerated, particularly among the Catholics.
And played by just a whole succession of beautiful women, Jean Seberg, Ingrid Bergman. I mean, and a high school girl's dream. It was certainly mine to be martyred in that glorious way. You know, what else could you hope for?
Well, also, I was struck by the biographer. I mean, she's a relative of one of the a great niece of one of the characters, but the fact that she's writing about someone who's evil, who really did evil. We're not just talking about Google, do no evil here, like we were in the last segment. I'm talking about evil from the Reich and Hitler and all that, and who nevertheless wants to understand, you know, what made her tick, wants to understand what led her into this, and maybe even understand it in a way that borders on compassion.
Well, the biographer, Natalie, c'est moi, or say a more neurotic version of moi. I mean, she made it possible for me to write the book. That is, Lou was the hardest character to write for obvious reasons. I mean, someone so evil and so mysterious, and I couldn't do it. So
couldn't tell the story from her.
From her point of view. So I tried first person. I tried second person letters. I tried, I don't know, journal entries, diaries, blah, blah, blah. Nothing worked. And then I had this kind of crummy French biography from the 70s of Villette Morris. And I thought, well, I'll just write my own crummy biography right now. So I invented the biographer. And the minute I did that, it became possible in a way because my problems with the character became her problems with the character. And also because she's so self-obsessed that she can't stop talking about her own problems. So as the book gets darker and darker, she becomes more and more self-obsessed, which gave me just a little bit of humor to leaven the darker parts of the novel with.
Early on in the novel, in her voice, Lou Villars did evil, unforgivable things. So what does it say about the biographer, me, that researching and writing her life has given new meaning and purpose to my own less dramatic, less reprehensible existence?
I think me is the operative word there.
C'est moi, again, like you said. There's also, I mean, there's a kind of moving, in many ways, sense of unrequited love in this book, too. I mean, the Baroness, and I don't want to give away too much here, but the first time, for example, our Henry Miller-type character meets the Baroness, he doesn't like her, and the woman who's with him, Suzanne, his girlfriend, and there's a triangle, she doesn't like the Baroness. And then suddenly the Baroness opens up as this character that we see in very different ways.
She's one of my favorite characters. She, and I found her the most moving character. I mean, there's a section, one of my favorite sections later on, she's talking about the photograph that Gabor took of her and her looking at it much later and seeing things in the photo that she didn't see at the time. Plus, she's the character who I think behaves most unpredictably. You know, I mean, once the war comes, everyone in the book has to make a decision about what they're going to do.
What side they're on.
Yeah. I mean, some people run away, some people stay, some work for the resistance, some do nothing. And she makes, I think, the most unpredictable decision. And then there's another part that I really liked later on where she and, again, not to spoil it, but she and Yvonne, the owner of the Chameleon Club, are involved in a sort of adventure. And they're driving and eating Nazi speed as they and it was a way to write about female friendship and adventure and so forth. And it, again, hugely entertaining for me.
Yvonne, who's also Hungarian, by the way, comes across as wonderfully sentimental right from the beginning with all this stuff about lost sailors and things of that sort. And she's really an impresario. I mean, the Chameleon Club is a place of entertainment, of shows, of performances.
And she's adaptive. I mean, for better or worse, she's adaptive. You know, the club, the Chameleon Club, is based on a real club that was called Luminoco. And I didn't know what happened to it. And then recently I was reading a biography of Jane Bowles, and it turned out that she hung out there in the 50s. So not only did it survive the war, but it survived, you know, at least as far as I know, up until the late 50s.
Chameleon Club also, I mean, there's a lizard in this that Yvonne carries around and tells fortunes with and everything. But Chameleon also suggests the kind of adaptability of these people in general. I
mean, yeah. And the club also becomes, again, for better or worse, or in this case worse, a kind of venue for the nationalism that took over France in the 30s. Because Yvonne needed to survive, and she allowed her club to become a place where nationalistic songs could be sung.
Well, she was accommodating, and she was chameleon-like herself in so many ways. We're talking again, if you've just joined us, with Francine Prose. Her new novel is Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. It's a hell of a good read, and I'd like to invite those of you listening to join us. In fact, lots of things to talk about in this book. It's a rich book, and not only brings into focus this terribly troubling time when the French were essentially moving toward what would become the Vichy transformation, but also really gives us a picture of Paris, as Francine, I think, said so eloquently, before it's changed into whatever it is now, before it's gone through its morphing and its metamorphosis. We do welcome your calls, and you can join us now. We do, in fact, invite you to join our conversation. Toll-free number available is 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org. Opportunity for you to talk to one of our leading writers, Francine Prose, about her new novel or about whatever's on your mind. You can also go to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, and you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. This is someone who retains her humility and charm despite being called the Hope Diamond of literature. We do welcome your involvement in the program. And there's just so much to talk about in this novel, but I want to hear from listeners, and I want to hear particularly maybe from those of you who have some thoughts about how Paris operates in your imaginations. I mean, it's so much a rich part of this book, even though it's Paris kind of, dare we say, before the fall or before the Vichy or before whatever.
Well, before the Vichy and then before the Abercrombie and Fitch took over.
I mean, before the commercialization of Paris, or
exactly,
the commodification of Paris. I know the people in the French consul that here listen to this program. I hope nobody's getting offended, but you know, there is a kind of homogenization and commercialization. Anyway, like to hear from you. Join us on our Facebook page, tweet us, Twitter handle @KQED Forum, or call us 866-733-6786. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Francine Prose, novelist, essayist, and writer for many years, who has distinguished herself with a number of books which have been featured here on Forum. The newest one is a novel. It's called Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. And talking about France, talking about the years of well, when many Americans were over there, you know, Pound and Eliot and Gertrude Stein and so forth, who may have also been a collaborator. I don't know if I want to put that out there, but there's a lot of questions that are raised about why she and Toklas were sort of sacrosanct. I mean, she had a close friend who happened to be a homosexual high up in the Gestapo ranks, but they left her alone. They didn't bother her. And they were lesbians and they were Jewish.
Well, they went south for a while, and she somehow managed to get gasoline to drive south when nobody had gasoline. I mean, all these questions. But there were a lot of people, French and Americans, who got by, who had complicated histories. I mean, Coco Chanel was a famous one.
She was a sympathizer of the Nazis.
A sympathizer. Chevalier was a sort of questionable presence. Simone de Beauvoir. I mean, all these people now who we think of as pure, upstanding, moral, were not quite so pure during the war.
Not to mention across the border, like Heidegger and Daman and people of that sort. By the way, you are certainly welcome to join our conversation. It's toll-free at 866-733-6786. And you can email us, forum@kqed.org. Napoleonic law keeps creeping in here, too.
Yeah, Napoleonic law. Apparently, it was against Napoleonic law to be a cross-dresser. And then the law was modified. So by the time of the period I'm writing in, the French had passed a law saying that that it was illegal to wear more than 5 items of clothing of the opposite gender. So the cops had a great deal of pleasure arresting people and stripping them and counting how many items of clothing that they were wearing. So forth.
So strange when you think, I mean, because people so often identify France as being this, loosey-goosey when it comes to sexuality type of country, culturally.
Well, it also has a big, you know, it's also a Catholic country, so it's not, it's a mixture, let's say.
Were you inspired by police open up as the code word to get into the Chameleon Club, or was that
That was another one of those. I mean, what would the perfect password be? Police open up. And I wanted it near the beginning so people knew that there would be humor in the book as well as all, you know, history, complication, darkness, because I wanted to mix all those things together.
Yeah, and you write, actually, you use the word at one point with Lou about a dark thread. I mean, is this something like a spool is pulling her back? There's a whole scene early on in her childhood. There's, in fact, a quest to find her brother, which is really part of one of the main plot lines here, kind of subplot line. But her brother, who seems to be disturbed, was disturbed and all, and we see that as part of what shapes her to a great extent. I mean, you were intentional on that in terms of the biographer, weren't you?
No, yeah. And also, I mean, there are all sorts of dark threads, I think. I mean, one is, speaking of Shinnok, the police chief, he keeps reoccurring. I mean, all these people, all the characters, the narrators, are all kind of bound up in each other's lives and tied to one another, even though they might not choose to be. I mean, they just can't kind of get out of each other's lives. So the dark threads certainly come from her childhood and, you know, knowing that she wanted to dress as a boy from the time she was very, very young. And then her parents making a series of dubious choices about her upbringing, her, you know, the sadistic governess and so forth. And then the brother of the nun, her first trainer, who's sketchy is a mild word for describing him. So she had very bad luck in addition to having some complications in her own psyche.
Talk about Shinnok, though, because, you know, he's very jealous of her because he winds up with a woman that she was involved with and really tries to do dirty and does dirty by her. Tries to essentially let go a lot of animus and vindictiveness. But when it comes to making a deal, everything is erased.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Well, again, you know, on all sorts of levels. I mean, Hitler had, as we all know, huge opposition to homosexuality and so forth. But he and Heydrich knew that Lou would be very valuable, or Violette Morris actually would be very valuable to them, because she had a huge network of connections all over France, because she went and lectured at these regional sports associations, women's sports associations. So she knew people all over the country. And she was in an ideal position to tell them where there were troop movements or new construction projects, because she knew women in all these places, and the women had husbands or boyfriends who were involved in all these things that were of interest to the military.
And when you try to explore and really get behind her motives, what you realize is that I mean, part of it is romance with this German athlete, Inga, who was also an auto racer. But she was dazzled by the Reich. She was dazzled by the Führer and all of what Nazism was, and apparently in similar ways that Leni Riefenstahl may have been dazzled, though she was German, of course.
Leni Riefenstahl, who also makes a cameo appearance
yes.
in the novel, and whose film I watched over an Olympiad, one of the most boring films ever made. I watched over and over and over because I
boring but brilliant cinematography.
Boring but beautiful.
Yeah.
I had to, because I needed to know what the various teams, national teams, were wearing as they passed the reviewing stand and what the Führer's reaction was. And then there was a huge controversy about whether they would give the fascist salute or the Olympic salute. So I had to kind of keep that straight, what everybody was doing with their arms, really.
Yeah, this is a prodigious amount of research that went into this novel.
For someone with no memory, I think I did a pretty good job. So.
No memory. No. I mean, you dug up a lot of stuff, and that's, I mean, just the historical period itself comes alive. It's fascinating to be there. I felt very much like I was there and didn't want to be there, of course. It's a troubling time and a very difficult time, and there's also a lot of torture in here. There's a lot of painful stuff that you had to write about.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, as I said, it was difficult, but by that point in the novel, I was so immersed in that world, and there was such a weird, complicated pleasure in to going to my office and sitting at my desk, and suddenly I was no longer in 2010, 12, you know, 11, 12. I was in 1932. I was in 1940, and I was these characters who were moving through me in a strange way. I mean, I really, you know, you hear writers say these things and you think, yeah, whatever. But I really felt that I was channeling these voices and that I was hearing them and that they had things that they wanted to say about that time.
It's a good time, actually, to ask a question of listeners. I mean, when you read a novel, this is a historical novel. It's placed as, well, we're moving through a couple decades here, but mainly 1932, as the title suggests. When you read a novel and you're in a different era, are you in that different era? I mean, is your imagination transported? Does it have that kind of effect on you? And what is it? Well, you know, I'm talking about maybe something that's mysterious about fiction here, but nevertheless that I believe in, that it can be a vehicle to actually put you in a different time and place. I'd like to throw that question out to listeners and get some response from you. And, of course, you can feel free to join us with Francine Prose, I know a lot of you haven't read this novel. I hope you will because it's really worth reading. But you may have a desire to join the conversation. And if you do, you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, which is kqed.org/forum. And you can also call us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. And we would like to hear from you, particularly this question about whether you get so involved in a novel sometimes that you actually find yourself in a different time and place. That was, frankly, part of the impact that this novel had on me, and other novels have had on me, but this one quite a bit. Also brings up another question about what this novel does. We're talking about all the multiple points of view and all of the spiraling and juggling and all that sort of thing. You're putting a certain collaborative role onto the reader here, really, aren't you? I mean, in terms of what truth might be or what truth is?
Yeah. I mean, there's so many possible versions that are offered that the reader has to make certain decisions about what actually happened. And then, again, no spoilers, but there's a huge reverse at the end that just sort of turns everything on its upside down or on its side. And I don't know, what does the reader do with that? I mean, do you go back and read the book, I mean, again, in a whole other way, knowing what you find out by the end? I don't know. I mean, because it was easy for me because I didn't know what was going to happen at the end, so I didn't have to think about that. And then when I got to the end, I went, whoops.
It just came on you.
It just came on me, yeah.
Well, that's another interesting question to put out to you as reader, as so many readers who listen to the show. I mean, when you get a surprise ending, I mean, a shocking ending, we're not talking about O'Henry-type stories, but, you know, something that really unmoors you, do you feel you have to go back and reread? I might think of some examples of that. Here's actually David who writes online, intriguing concept, just finished reading Hemingway's A Movable Feast, again, so the timing is good. And I think Movable Feast, well, it does kind of transport us too, doesn't it?
It does. I don't, you know, I loved that book when I was young. It's another one I reread for this. And it was another one that I didn't like as much as I did when I was, you know, I thought,
funny
oh,
how that happens.
It's funny how that happens. Yeah. I know, big mistake. But, you know, it was so romantic and so forth. And now I thought, this time I read it, I thought there's something so ungenerate. I mean, the way, for example, the way he writes about Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas, you know, he sees them as so icky in a way. And yet, Gertrude Stein had a huge effect on him. I mean, the famous Hemingway sentence is actually a Gertrude Stein sentence. Mm-hmm.
She was more of an editor in some ways than Max Perkins was to Fitzgerald mm-hmm. or Thomas Wolfe or Hemingway himself. I think in some ways he was probably jealous of Stein, put off by her. You know, he was just so competitive. You know, he was competitive with her in the way he was with just about everybody.
Any other writer especially.
Yeah, and she was a writer. I mean, some people seem to forget that. But she certainly was. What do you think about Gertrude Stein, by the way? I mean, as a writer.
I remember liking, what was it, Three Lives? And, yeah. And of course, the autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, I remember loving. But if someone, well, just to be perfectly frank, if someone put a gun to my head and said, you have to read The Making of Americans now, I would go, shoot me.
Let me go back to Lionel, though, a character that I found myself fascinated with. He's a Jersey City boy, and he's actually... being supported by his ex-wife. I mean, this is, where'd this come from?
Henry Miller. I mean, he was a Brooklyn boy, of course, a Brownsville boy, but he also had the wife back at home that was every so often sending him a little check when things got really bad.
Didn't know that. So it mm-hmm. taught me something about Henry Miller I didn't know. Taught me a lot about many other things as well here. And are these characters gone? I mean, now that the book is out and it's finished and it's circulating...
I miss them so much. Well, you know, I'm working on a little biography for Yale University Press of Peggy Guggenheim. And one of the reasons I agreed to do it is that it meant that I didn't have to leave that era, that I could still stay there. So, and the Baroness is a little bit based on Peggy Guggenheim. I mean, the art collecting and the sort of manic art collecting on the eve of World War II, where both of them could buy large amounts of art at cheap prices from desperate artists. That was taken from the life of Peggy Guggenheim. So... you know, and again...
Was she a virgin?
Yeah, for about 5 seconds.
Was she at Hollywood?
She was not in Hollywood, but she had a very complicated love life. It was like time travel. It really was for me when I was writing it, which is another childhood fantasy, wild desire that I've always had. So I did it.
That's why I'm interested in hearing from listeners about whether they do that time traveling when they're reading. I mean, it's one thing to... recreate a time and place with a rich imagination that someone like Francine Prose has, but you're the readers. And as readers, I wonder to what extent, I mean, there's a certain onus on you to recreate yourself and that time and place, but just how much it actually, I mean, I suppose it depends a lot on the vividness of the prose.
Well, I didn't want to write what I think of as a typical historical novel. That is, you know,
this is not a typical. This is not. Didn't fear that. No.
You know, the novels that spend three pages on what kind of bow ties everybody wore. You know, so this is really. It's the characters were more important to me than anything else, and they just happened to live at a different time and place. But really, they were the things that kept me going through the book, and I miss them as much as I miss it. You know, imaginatively living in Paris in the '20s and thirties and forties.
But that's what I want to get at with you. What is it about that particularly compels you or drew you? I mean, you said you really miss the characters. I can understand, but you really like being in Paris. You're still Peggy Guggenheim. You're still with.
I'm still there. Well. Partly it was because it was so romantic and bright and exciting, but also the joy of not being yourself, of getting a chance every day to just become somebody else and actually imagine that you are that person and imagine you're living in a different time. I mean, who doesn't want to live in Paris in the 20s? So I got to do it for a while. It was great.
But novelists do that all the time with all kinds of different characters and places and so forth. What for you about Paris in the 20s?
Well... again, the romance. I mean, when I was doing the Peggy Guggenheim biography, and then looking back, everybody was there. I mean, the art that was being created, and the writing, and the sense of freedom, and for the American expatriates, the sense that they were all just reinventing themselves and making up their lives as they were going along, and you know, the fact that they're all hanging out at this crossdressers club. I mean, there were crossdressers club in New York at the time, but this was something special.
What do you as a writer make of cross-dressing? I mean, you know, all this talk and all this stuff about gender bending, and you've got Elizabethan scholars now calling themselves pre-modernists who are talking all about Shakespeare and the boys playing women and all that sort of thing. But it really is a pretty widespread phenomenon. I'm not just talking about transvestism and cross. I'm just talking about cross-dressing in androgynous ways.
I'm fascinated by it. I always have been, and by questions of gender. I mean, the only time when I was pregnant with my sons, who are now 31 and 35, at that point, the only maternity clothes that existed were like baby clothes. So I cross-dressed for 9 months. I mean, I wore, you know, large men's suits. And it felt great to be an enormously pregnant person wearing men's suits. So I have some sense of why you might want to be wearing somebody else's clothes. I mean, if the choice was between dressing like a five-year-old girl and a guy, I'd certainly go for dressing like a guy.
Well, so, I mean, that gave you some understanding of Lou on a deeper level, I presume.
Yeah, on a fashion level.
On a fashion level.
But well, I went to a lot of drag shows when I was writing this.
You?
And there's a guy in New York named Justin Vivian Bond, who's really gifted, who does a lot of shows at Joe's Pub and so forth, who's a drag performer. And I saw him every opportunity I could because, you know, what was I writing about? The mystery of evil. But the mystery of gender, too, was going all the way through the book.
Some of our local listeners may remember Finocchio's. Did you know Finocchio's?
No.
It was a place in San Francisco that was essentially very popular for a long time. It was a major tourist attraction. I'm kind of a tourist magnet. It was men essentially dressed not only as women, but looking very much like women. Mm-hmm. I mean, crossing over the gender boundary in terms of the personas that they would create. You know, it's like some of these guys who do Judy Garland in Vegas or that sort of
right.
thing. But it was just a whole line of them, you know. Let me bring a caller in. And Linda, that's you. Hi, Linda. Join us.
Yes, hi. This is Linda from La Honda, California. I've been really enjoying listening to you all talk about Paris and the different time frames. And it actually reminded me of a movie I saw that's fairly recent. I think it's a Woody Allen film called Midnight in Paris.
Yeah, we referenced it, yeah.
Yeah. I really enjoy him. There's so much that's not taught, in formal education about Paris. And I wondered if the writer has any comments in terms of how maybe in the United States history around those time frames and about France and Paris in specific should be changed, if she had any opinions about textbooks on history on those time frames in her book.
Well, yeah, it's a good question. What do I want to say? I think that the more kids learn about history in general and history of that period, I mean, you know, every so often they do these surveys and they find out like, you know, three American teenagers know what the Holocaust was. So, you know, it's extremely important to know what happened in Paris, what happened in France, what happened in Europe. And also, you know, when I was doing research for the book, there was a certain point, I was reading a book about France between the wars, and there was a paragraph about what the problems were, what people were dealing with. And it was problems because people felt there was excessive immigration. There were too high taxes. People were not being able to raise their children in the style that they had, you know, to live better lives. I called up a friend of mine and I read that paragraph and it went on and on. And she said, "Is that about now?" And I went, "No, it's
but
about
it could
Paris.
Be.
It could be. It
yes.
was about Paris in the 30s. So again, incredibly instructive. And you know, one of the things that happened then, obviously, I read a lot about fascism and the origins of fascism. And if you take people who don't have enough to eat, who are poor, who feel the way the German people were told to feel, that they had been stabbed in the back by the Treaty of Versailles, resentment. You take poverty, privation, resentment, and add a demagogue to that, and you have this tinderbox. So, and that can happen at any time, anywhere, now, here, anywhere. So I think another reason it's important to know about history of that time, that place, is to just be aware of the signs if they seem to be happening.
Well, Sinclair Lewis and Philip Roth both wrote novels about, you know, alternate histories of mm-hmm. what could have happened in the United States if that tinderbox had come together in the way you describe. A listener writes, are you familiar with the espionage writer Alan Furst, who writes about the same time period in Paris?
Oh, he's a wonderful writer. Of course I am. Spies of Warsaw is a terrific book.
Any other novels cascade themselves into your consciousness here that you would mention?
Well, I read a lot of memoir, and great memoirs. I mean, there's a book called Memoirs of Montparnasse by a writer named John Glasgow of that time, which is fantastic. And then it seems that everyone in the resistance wrote a memoir about their adventures and heroism, which I just stole from shamelessly because two of my characters are writing resistance memoirs.
Let's bring another caller on. Anita joining us. Hi.
Good morning. I'm sorry I didn't hear it from the start, but I was an au pair in Paris in the late 60s, early 70s. And I'm fascinated by your talk because we were all fascinated by Paris, even though many of us had not read the literature from that time that you're discussing or about the time. It was, in some ways, truly magical. And it was an everyday experience with studies and some extraordinarily charming French people who were nothing like the Americans perceive them. Nasty and arrogant, truly kind people. I must say it is a love letter to Paris at my time with three children in a country house and there's a townhouse in Paris.
Well, thank you for those recollections and impressions. You have any sense of how do you regard the French? Talk about your open-ended questions. No, I mean, there's so much just in her response there that I resonate to. I mean, people who speak about the French as their generosity and their love of sensuality and so forth, and people who speak about them as, you know, craven and being arrogant and so forth. I mean, this is probably true about many nationalities and many people, but it's true in spades for the French.
It is true. It's extremely true. I mean, their culture, their history, their art. And then, you know, one of the things I always kind of knew about and found out a lot more about was the history of French anti-Semitism, which is just harrowing. Yeah, and has not ended. So
you got a listener who says maybe not, we're not getting flooded with calls because this is such a painful period for some people, or maybe even for most people. You're listening to Forum. We're talking with author Francine Prose. Her new novel is Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. But when you write about the French nationalism, you're writing about a kind of Gallic pride that has, I mean, you know, at this time, nationalism was so rife, not only in Germany, I mean, throughout Europe, throughout Western Europe particularly.
Still is,
right? I mean, well, Ukraine, right?
Sure. But also, you know, again, all the conflicts over immigration, there's not a single country in Europe and here that isn't touched by it. You know, I remember being at a literary conference in France, and all the American writers were encouraged to criticize the Bush-Cheney regime, which we were only too happy to do, by the French. But then during the intermissions, I would say something like, so what about the headscarf thing? And then the French would suddenly become these rabid nationalists saying, well, the French culture, blah, 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 blah. So it's very complicated.
It's always complicated. A listener named Jim in Chicago who writes, what role does music play in your novel? For example, does Mabel Mercer, that was a cabaret singer who performed at Shea Bricktop, make an appearance in your guest novel?
She doesn't, but Josephine Baker does. And there's music all the way through it. I mean, the Chameleon Club, again, being able to choreograph their dance routines and write their music for them. And one of the performers, Lou's girlfriend, is a cabaret singer, and she, as I mentioned, becomes a kind of nationalistic cabaret singer. And honestly, one of the things I was thinking of is there's a scene in Sacha Baron Cohen, Ali G, where he's in a bar and singing this horrible anti-Semitic song and gets everybody to sing rousingly along with it. So inspiration came from a wide variety of sources.
You know, I actually met Josephine Baker. And
really?
Many, many years ago, she was in Berkeley. And I happened to be with the writer Ishmael Reed, and we went over to meet her. And it was a bit of a thrill. I mean, especially since I hadn't become so immunized to meeting celebrities at that point in my life, and she was something else.
Well, she was quite a celebrity. And she had a great history during the war. She supposedly worked for the resistance. She was living in a chateau outside Paris and apparently hid refugees in her chateau. So she was, by contrast, squeaky clean.
You know who else worked for the resistance? I'm sure you know this, but maybe a lot of listeners don't. Was Samuel Beckett.
Oh, yeah. Well, although later he referred to his resistance activities as Boy Scout stuff, but he also was referred to in the novel because he went south to Roussillon during the war and became involved. He'd been involved in the resistance in Paris and went literally mad from boredom in the south of France and was happy to get back to Paris.
It's a woman who says she has no memory. here's Leanne. Leanne, join us. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question for the author. How would you say the culture of cross-dressing and gender bending compare between Europe and the U.S. today?
I don't really know much about European cross-dressing now. I know I've learned a great deal about it in the United States, but
I think maybe she means then and
then?
America now, yeah.
Then or now?
Either one, really.
Well, then, I mean, then there was something, I think, even more forbidden and louche about it. You know, it was certainly in Berlin and in Paris, and there were these clubs. I mean, now, you know, in San Francisco, you know, I remember when I lived in San Francisco briefly in the 70s, and I'd left Cambridge, Massachusetts, which was the most repressed and uptight town, and I remember going into a Cala Foods Market. It was Cala, right?
Yeah.
Right. And the coquettes were there, and they were dressed in drag with, you know, their hairy chests and their evening gowns and their wigs. And I just was so happy. I loved it so much. I thought, oh, I have left the place I shouldn't be and come to the place where I should be. So thank you, San Francisco.
And thank you, Leanne, for your call. And here's Paul. Paul, join us. Hi.
Yes, I'm just on my way to both Germany and France. I'm very curious as to what degree there was rise of a Nazi movement in France, because I just read a book about how Senator Prescott Bush hired Hitler and how the Americans were actually behind the Nazi movement in Germany, and I'm wondering to what degree do people know that in France or Germany? Do they still blame the Germans, or do they put some of the blame on the Americans who set the whole thing up for World War II?
Well, you know, one of the reasons that I wrote this book as fiction instead of nonfiction was that my then French editor said the French are still so sensitive, hypersensitive, about their collaboration history and their history during World War II that you would have to spend 2 years in the Bibliothèque Nationale doing research so that you could back up every single thing you say with facts, which I didn't want to do. So I wrote it as a novel instead. But it was interesting to me that she said that this sensitivity is still there. I mean, I'm curious to see. The novel's now being translated into French, so I'm very curious to see what the reaction of the French is after it comes out there.
Was that what convinced you to do it as a novel rather than
yeah.
didn't want to do all that research?
It's those 2 years in the library.
Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Francine Prose, the new novel, Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And remind you, you can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.